Football Weekly. Spectacular scoring chances, fumbles in the box and one side going down. It was a busy weekend on the Queen's front lawn and in the world of football. And in today's roundup, we bring you Chelsea-Barcelona Part 2. After Barca's 6-2 morning in Madrid, is 9 behind the ball enough? And what of the Gunners clash with Man United at the Emirates? Meanwhile, in the Premier League, we got the latest on what you'd call a relegation battle, if there was anyone battling. And as Birmingham book their place in next year's relegation scrap, we get the final day roundup on the Championship. Abroad, there's Steve McClaren getting carried away. The greatest game ever played in Greece that didn't involve two girls wrestling. The latest from the Bundesliga and Italy, where the top division is breaking away like Mrs. Berlusconi and the Juventus locker room is not far behind. All of that, plus your post and the winner of our Finnish Shawnee's Sentence competition in Football Weekly. Right, on board today, everybody. We've got Barry Glendenning.
Hello, James.
Hi, Barry. John Ashdown.
Hi, James.
Hi, John. And hi, Raphael Honigstein.
Hi.
With a lineup like that, how can it be anything but a particularly terrific Football Weekly with special guest producer Ben? And, well, so much to talk about this week. That thrilling Middlesbrough-Man United clash. Well, let me see. Arsenal's thrilling clash with Portsmouth. All the games were completely one-sided. From the title race point of view, no change there. Man City, are they going to offer any kind of opposition next week, do you think? Because they had their third straight win, and it looks like they're back in. They got their mojo back.
You'd like to think they would.
Yeah.
Just for no other reason than it's a Manchester derby, and they often do put up a fight, and they have been playing well. Rubino seems to have found his mojo, and is obviously playing for a place, either a lucrative transfer in the summer or his place in the side next season. But yeah, I'd like to think they could get a result against United. Yeah.
Well, I also think they might be persuaded by Marcus that it's not an away game and then they might actually turn up. I think, well, yeah. I mean, they've certainly got enough to play for, not right. just for themselves, but also just to know United a bit.
Yeah, indeed. So, well, that's coming up on the weekend. Of course, before that, Man United, who are just 3 points clear still of Liverpool, will face this Champions League clash with Arsenal. Now, Arsenal did get the chance, as Sir Alex had warned, to rest bundles of players. I think fully eight or so of his starting lineup were taking it easy for the game against Portsmouth. A 3-0 win. Arshavin in fabulous form. There was his noble attempt to deny the penalty that the referee gave him.
Arsenal did try their best to not score it by giving it to Bentner to take, I suppose, didn't they? Although he did put it in,
yes,
it's not unheard of, though, is it? I mean, it was nice, and he didn't sort of, although he sort of waved his finger and pointed to the corner flag, he didn't then go up to the referee and said, "No, really, don't give it."
Yeah,
and he was sort of smiling after a fashion, and they didn't blaze it over the bar.
Right, so wasn't that noble?
Well, it was. I suppose I'm just being
picky. I take your point, but in perspective of the Champions League semi final against Manchester United, Arsenal, who really did look put back in their box by United in the first leg. Was that just a blip? Are things going to come together for them at the Emirates?
I'm just disappointed because I really wanted to see Pat Rice and Arsene Wenger turn out, as Alex Ferguson predicted. No, I think that all this pre-match talk is almost as if the golden goal rule has been reintroduced by stealth by UEFA. I presume that as soon as United score, the game's all over. And I think that is probably right. I don't think that Arsenal can score three against this United side, who haven't lost a game in 24 in the Champions League.
So, is it? No? Yeah. Mm. Rio Ferdinand likely to be fit again, which you'd think would make a big difference. Any chance, Barry, Arsenal coming back? Their only chance for silverware?
Well, I've confidently predicted so far the season, among other things, that Hull would be fighting for a European place, that Juventus would win the Champions League, and now I'm going to confidently predict that Arsenal will overcome the deficit and beat Manchester United tomorrow.
Is there anything you base that on?
I can see them scoring three goals at home.
Right.
They've often done it before, and there's no reason why they shouldn't do it tomorrow night. I said last week that I think Manchester United may have left this tie behind them in Old Trafford, and
by not scoring enough there.
Yeah, and Arsenal are very, very lucky to still be in with a chance of winning, and I think they'll take that chance.
Mm. Although the form that Wayne Rooney's in at the moment, you would hesitate to you wouldn't, but most sentient beings would hesitate to gamble against.
Yeah, and that second goal on Saturday was wonderful, wasn't it? The way it was created and the movement. And although Arsenal's defence probably won't give United as much space as Middlesbrough, They do look in decent form, don't they, United? And to be honest, I can't see them. I can't see Arsenal overhauling it.
3 points anyway. The gap is still at the top. Liverpool doing a number on Newcastle, who appear to be going down faster than Ricky Hatton, despite the arrival of Alan Shearer. And they really didn't look bothered, did they? The Newcastle back line, or any of them, in fact.
Despite the arrival, I know some would say because of the arrival. It's funny because so many teams down at the bottom are normally you'd expect a few of them to start winning games, but it's just not happening at all. It looks like, say, Sunderland may well stay up, despite none of their players showing the slightest inclination of wanting to play in the Premier League next season. They've no fight.
Well, is it that, or is it, as somebody was suggesting the other day, that plenty of these players are quite looking forward to their clubs going down so that they can walk out on their contracts and go to a much better place elsewhere? Raphael's pointing to himself with a big grin on his face. Was that you, Raphael?
Yes. Yeah.
You think that, you know, Mikio and et al., although he wasn't particularly involved, it was Viduka's assist for Liverpool's first goal that led me to think that maybe the one group of people on Tyneside who won't be heartbroken to see the Magpies going down is the team itself.
Well, he won't get another lucrative deal like that, so I'm not sure it's in his particular interest to walk away from that contract. But it is a bit strange, I think, the way that this year's been going. It's almost as if the teams who are down there still, despite the fact that it's only three games to go, still don't want to believe they're actually fighting against relegation somehow and trying to, well, not play their way out of it, but sort of keep on playing or not playing, as it were, which is really bizarre.
Well, none of the bottom half won. Hull is still yet to play. They're playing tonight against Aston Villa, but for all the lack of quality around them, it does look as though the bottom three at the moment, would you not say, John, are probably going to be the bottom three at the end of the season?
I think if there's a winner between Newcastle and Middlesbrough next weekend, a week today, the winner of that will stay up. If it's a draw, I think they'll both go. And it's weird, isn't it? It's slightly perverse that West Brom are the team that seems to, the only team who've been, you know, been condemned for months, are probably the only team showing a bit of fight. They were pretty good at White Hart Lane on Saturday and still lost.
But apparently Newcastle were so confident of that relegation battle wouldn't be an issue that they haven't even factored in that to their players' contracts. So if they were to go down, the likes of Viduka, Owen, whoever, would all still be on the same money, despite playing in the second tier.
Would Owen get a game in the Championship, do you think?
I don't know. Would he be good enough?
Right. He's only 29. Isn't it extraordinary? I mean, I know he's had injuries.
Well, he's had so many injuries. He's lost his pace, which was his big weapon, but I'm sure he'll score goals at some stage again. But there was talk last week that perhaps Everton would be interested in him, so I don't know.
Joey Barton, John?
I mean, having a go at Joey Barton for making bad tackles is a bit like having a go at a fish for being wet and swimming around in rivers and things, isn't it?
If only you'd stopped halfway, that could have been another listener competition right there.
I mean, he's obviously a Burke, isn't he? Completely.
Okay.
I've tried to defend Mr. Barton quite a lot in this podcast, but you can't really. The only thing I'd say is it's a bit rich of Alan Shearer, who once tried to kick Neil Lennon's head clean off his shoulders in a game, for him to be so critical. But interestingly
enough, he wasn't caught for it.
Barton was at least up until that point making an effort to drive Newcastle forward, and they could really have done with him for the last two games, but now he's going to be suspended. And I would imagine that tackle would probably be his last act in a Newcastle shirt, whether they go down or stay up.
The shame is, I remember watching him for Manchester City against Wigan a few years ago when Man City got beaten 4-0, but Barton was brilliant, and he generally could be a really, really good player, but he's just got this streak in him that obviously entirely ruins it. The other interesting thing, I think, about Newcastle at the moment is the assumption in the North East press is that Shearer is there for the long term, and that Kinnear was hoping to get the sort of director of football job, which is now gone because Dennis Wise has gone. But that assumption that he was going to stay in the long term, I think, was also based on the assumption that he was going to keep them up. And it's hard to see Alan Shearer managing in the Championship.
So in other words, they're looking for their 11th manager in about 5 years.
Could be, although I suppose they might sort of stick with Kinnear.
Right, well, Sunderland down the road apparently are looking to replace Ricky Sprazier. And I read with interest that the 20 boss, Steve McLaren, is a hot favourite. Barry, I don't know how you'd feel about him at the Stadium of Light as a Sunderland fan.
I'd nearly take Alan Shearer at this stage instead of Ricky Spraggia, because Ricky Spraggia obviously isn't up to the job. But just come back to Shearer, I've kind of warmed to him slightly, and this is a sentence I never thought I'd say since he took the job. That, say, he did an interview on Football Focus on Saturday, and you know, he was quite honest and wasn't just spewing the usual banalities you'd expect from him. And then yesterday, he when the cop were slagging him off, he took that in good humour.
You should have stayed on the telly.
You should have stayed on the telly, yeah. And he sort of gave them a wave. Yeah. Do you?
I don't smile. Then. Right.
How
okay.
can they sing that though?
Have they not actually seen him on the telly? It'd be quite funny if he got back to the telly and found out that Lee Dixon and Martin Keown had actually usurped him on the sofa.
I think there's an unlikely scenario. But, anyway, we mentioned 20, and we should just salute Steve McLaren, because 20 are in the Champions League next year. They secured second place. Steve was carried from the field by the players. They carried him off.
There's going to be massive games in the Champions League.
I was going to say similar scenes to when he left the England job, only there were security men in that case. But anyway, well done to McLaren, because he's really... he's fought back against critics. Anyway, the other relegation things, West Brom, that brief revival ended at White Hart Lane, and West Ham beat Stoke, but it just looks like the bottom three are just going to be so adept at being miserable that all the others will be without any problems. Now, very shortly, what will be going down here on the pod is a phone call with Sid Lowe as we get the Master's view on the big story in European football this weekend, Barcelona's incredible 6-2 defeat of Real Madrid. That's in part two.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello.
Hi, Sid. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well as well. John Ashton, Barry Glendinning and Raphael Honigstein joining me here. You were at the Bernabeu for an absolutely historic piece of Spanish football on Saturday night.
Yeah, it really was quite extraordinary. I must admit, I thought for a while that Real Madrid were going to get away with it, in so much as, you know, they scored the first goal. And then at 3-2, you had this feeling that, hang on a minute, maybe there's another incredible twist in this. Because Barcelona have missed so many chances, and the lesson of this season has tended to be that teams that miss chances against Madrid end up paying for it. In the end, they of course, didn't pay for it. They scored 6. They could probably have scored 10. I thought Barcelona were spectacularly good. That said, I also thought that tactically Real Madrid played into the hands completely, and in particular the decision to play a very, very high defensive line just allowed Thierry Henry to completely and utterly tear Sergio Ramos apart.
Which he did. Is he going to play, though, midweek?
Well, this is an interesting one, because Thierry Henry said after the game that he felt fine, that he'd fallen on his knee, that it was a little bit sore, but that taking him off was simply a sensible precaution, and he was hopeful of playing against Chelsea. But the news I just had literally about 5 minutes ago from Catalunya is that it looks like he's going to be out of action for 10 days to 2 weeks, which means, of course, missing the Chelsea game. A real shame for him, a shame as well for Barcelona, because he's actually played very well in the Champions League this year, because, again, he was fantastic against Real Madrid at the weekend. And obviously, I think Guardiola feels that he's someone who knows how to play against English clubs. But it might be that it's not that bad a thing for Barcelona, because it almost gives them the excuse to put Iniesta at the top of the pitch and add an extra physical body in the midfield.
Interesting. It's just that he looked like their most outstanding player on Saturday.
And I think, well, he was on Saturday. I thought he was brilliant. Although, I mean, you know, most outstanding player, they were all pretty good. And Xavi Hernandez, I thought, was playing the game with an insulting ease, just kind of strolling away from Real Madrid. And Leo Messi, I thought, was brilliant as well. And tactically, that was a very interesting shift from Pep Guardiola, to play Messi as a central striker, dropping off rather than on the right-hand side coming in, as he tends to do. And also, Henry's been very good in recent weeks at a time when there's been one or two question marks about Barcelona, partly because he's played, I think it's now 10 games fewer than either Eto'o or Messi, and he looks that little bit fresher. So it is a real shame. But as I say, tactically, it may not be a bad thing.
Sid, how much can we read into this win? Because I admittedly only saw bits of it of the second half. And while Barcelona looked absolutely sensational, Real Madrid were playing the strangest zonal marking system I've ever seen, i.e. stay away from any opposing shirt as much as you can. And they had so much time and space on the ball, it was unreal. So, how good is this side? And, how bad were Real Madrid yesterday, really? On Saturday, sorry.
It's difficult, isn't it? And this is always the problem when a side appears to be absolutely brilliant, is that, you know, hang on, there's another side on the pitch. And to some extent, this is almost a continuation of the argument with the Chelsea game, isn't it? You know, but people saying Barcelona were poor, but then Chelsea made it very, very hard for them. And a good team that plays that defensively and that compact is always difficult to break down. Real Madrid with a complete reverse. They allowed Barcelona to play. I do think that it was an interesting game in a way, because what it did is it seemed to be a portrait of both sides, not just of Barcelona, but also of Real Madrid. I think it showed us that maybe Real Madrid's run was slightly false, that maybe their run as well, and I'm sure a lot of people won't want to hear this in Spain, but maybe their run as well was an indication of the fact that La Liga is not that strong this year, and actually probably wasn't that strong last year either. And that Real Madrid were very, very poor in defence. There's one or two players who have basically been found out by this result. Not because of this result, because one game anything can happen, but because it confirmed other things. In particular, I think Gabby Heinze is an ex-footballer now. I think he's just not good enough anymore. Fernando Gago never has been good enough. And it was made far, far too easy for Barcelona. But then by the same token, they've made a lot of teams look small this year. And people in Spain, at least, and certainly in Catalonia, are saying that this is one of the greatest teams they've ever seen. I think it's a bit premature to say that. But the way they play, the way they move the ball is certainly worth watching, that's for sure.
What about the scoreline? When was the last time Barcelona had a win that big in Madrid?
They never have. It's the first time they've ever scored six goals. They have won a 5-0 when Johan Cruyff was there as a player, which I think was 1973-74. It's only the second time ever that Real Madrid have conceded six goals at home. The last time was 1931, I think against Atletico Madrid.
Right.
And so there's certainly been online polls and so on and so forth, and lots of Real Madrid fans saying this is the most painful defeat we've ever had.
Wendy Ramos must have felt like he was back at Spurs or something, isn't
he? He must have done. And I think as well, he said something very interesting after the game, which again, to some extent, answers that question about just how good was this. And he said, look, the reality is, this is a side that's won 17 out of 18 in La Liga. The reality is we haven't beaten the big teams. Juan de Ramos, as coach, has played Liverpool twice, Barcelona twice, and Atletico Madrid once, and not won any of them. And there is that nagging doubt, which is that, hang on a minute, when you play someone who's actually quite good, Real Madrid can no longer do it.
So, Sid, how do you think this will affect Barcelona's game against Chelsea midweek?
No, I think it will give them confidence, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And one of the reasons for that is that I think Pep Guardiola, what he's done, amongst many other things, obviously, is he's allowed Barcelona to have a style that's very much their own. He's been very, very faithful to the way they approach games. And I think that means that they're not subject... Not subject even to those kind of ups and downs that a lot of sides suffer. Of course, there's questions about confidence. And of course, the game can change within the game as well. And I think that this is good for them because this has kind of got the league title out of the way. I think going into the first game against Chelsea, they were aware that the Real Madrid game was on the horizon. That's now been done, and this is very good for them. The bad side of it, I suppose, is that this may encourage Chelsea to again be defensive despite playing at home, and I do think that Barcelona will struggle to break them down. I think sometimes people underestimate just how difficult it is to break down an extremely defensive team, however good you are. And of course, there's the other thing that Chelsea would have looked at the game against Real Madrid and thought, yeah, they scored six goals, but they conceded two, and they were both dreadfully defended. And I do think Barcelona are going to struggle, particularly in the air from Chelsea.
Mm. But you don't regard the absence of Thierry Henry with Iniesta moving up as necessarily a big disadvantage for Barca?
Well, I think it's a big disadvantage because Henry gives him the pace, the drive. He's got the athleticism that Andres Iniesta doesn't have, but he maybe doesn't have the guile that Iniesta has. And also, I think that there was possibly a slight temptation for Pep Guardiola anyway to try and add an extra physical body to midfield. This almost gives him the excuse to do that. So it's not that I don't think it's a problem, because I think it's a blow, and I'm sure Guardiola would rather have had Henry available because he's played very well. But I think that the particular nature of who he's missing and who he's got to replace him means that this is possibly not the worst thing that could have happened to them. Much worse, of course, is the complete absence of centre-backs.
Well, listen, then, just to finish, your prediction for Wednesday's game?
I think Chelsea will go through. I think they'll win it 2-1.
Chelsea, of course, warmed up for Wednesday's clash at Stamford Bridge by beating Fulham. Using two strikers?
Well, they beat Fulham 3-1, so they're exactly half as good as Barcelona.
excellent. Very, very good. Now, John Ashton, that's maths. I don't know what you're scared of standing at the ceiling for.
So that, hang on, no, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, does it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Well, if Fulham are exactly as good as...
I see your point.
So if Fulham were Real Madrid, which they're not, then it would make sense. If Fulham were Real Madrid and Chelsea beat them 3-1.
Well, they play in white. Does there any other connections at all?
Not sure.
Let's go from the Champions League to the Championship. Hey,
that was neat.
Yeah, I thought so. Wolves were already up. We heard about that. Birmingham secured the other automatic promotion spot this weekend.
They did with a win at Reading. Mm-hmm. They did need, in the end, they could have gone up with a draw. I was at Selhurst Park watching Sheffield United, who needed to win to have any chance of going up, play out a 0-0 draw, surrounded by 7,500 happy, well, not very happy, actually, frustrated Yorkshiremen,
right.
Some of whom were dressed as Banana Man and Scooby-Doo and all the rest of it for their day out in London.
I actually saw Banana Man in... Clapham Junction train station yesterday morning on his way.
He would have been.
I was wondering where he was going. So yeah, Selhurst Park, obviously.
That's right. Yeah.
So who else? Were the Banana Man? Who else?
There was the Pink Panther I saw.
Right. Was there a big fat bloke dressed as a schoolboy?
There might have been. Tom Lutz claims to have seen a man dressed in basically it was a fat suit with a Hawaiian shirt with just an enormous penis hanging out the bottom.
Right.
Of it.
Okay.
Quite what it was supposed
surely
to be.
Surely he was on his way to Anfield, no?
Possibly.
Right. Might have been, okay. Might have been not a disguise at all.
Yeah. There was a man dressed as a can of Spam as well.
Right.
Who was one of the funniest things I've ever seen, actually, was in the man dressed. It might not have been the same man, but away game at Aston Villa when United were in the Premier League couple of seasons ago, a man dressed as a can of Spam was thrown out, and his grapple with the steward while dressed as a can of Spam, he was struggling because his arms were sort of restricted, his movement was restricted by the costume, right. While he was ejected.
Is that a trademark of Sheffield United?
Well, again, yeah, I think quite a few teams like to sort of for big occasions, but United fans don't waste an opportunity to get out the fancy dress costumes out the wardrobe.
How were you dressed, John?
Fortunately, I just had my United away shirt on and my trendy brown cardigan.
Right.
Although I went with my dad and my uncle and my brother, they all came down. And my uncle and brother claimed to have been very close to coming in fancy dress.
Right.
Fortunately, nobody did, because when we got back home to discover that my dad's car had been towed away, we had to traipse through East London to go and pick it up from the Hackney car pound. Arriving there dressed as Darth Vader and a couple of Mexicans would have been
would
the sight
be like
to behold.
That episode of Only Fools and Horses where Del and Rodney are dressed as Batman and Robin.
Why Mexicans? If there's ever a disguise not to adopt in the current climate, appearing like a Mexican.
I don't think they'd really.
Unless you want to get a seat on the tube on the way or something.
I think it was. I think it was budgetary reasons. I think they might have had some sombreros hanging around in the cupboard.
You see, a lot of John's relations have probably come down from Yorkshire, and people say, "Oh, look, it's a 1960s themed outing," but it would just be their normal clothes.
It was like an outing of the hillbillies, you know. Trying to work out how to use the tube and that sort of stuff was beyond them for much of the time.
Big London with no Hovis music playing in the background.
Bless. Now, anyway, back to the Championship. So well done, Birmingham. Is Alex McLeish going to stay? Apparently that's in big doubt.
Well, yeah, it was a strange one. There's a report in the Sunday tabloids saying that he would walk away regardless of the result.
Why? Because he's fallen out with Karen Watson?
Well, he's not. I mean, nobody, I don't think, would be particularly displeased to see him go. The fans aren't particularly enamoured of him. He has had sort of ructions with the boardroom. Back in March, Karen Brady, I think he was the chief executive, said they'd entered Phil Scolari territory and the team were less than the sum of their parts. Oh. Phil Scolari territory being the fact that literally the team weren't as good as they should be.
Didn't they become a byword for poor management, poor chap?
Yeah, it's a bit unfortunate, isn't it? But yeah, yesterday, apparently, she was blowing kisses to Alex on the field and that sort of thing, so they'd obviously patched it up. Right. But then McLeish came out afterwards and said that he, you know, let's see what happens in the next few days, and as far as I'll know, I'll be here next season. So he wasn't entirely forthright on the fact that he was going to stay. It would be strange to see him leave.
Yeah, indeed.
He does seem to be very unpopular, considering he's got them promoted. It's difficult to see what else he could have done apart from win the championship. But I think most of Birmingham's players are out of contract during the summer, so the potential is there for them to rebuild completely with a new manager. I often think some managers should be sacked. If they win promotion for the championship, get rid of them and get someone else in with decent Premier League pedigree.
Mm. David Gold at the start of the season said to him, get us promoted. No matter how you do it, just get us promoted. And that's what they've done. I mean, they haven't done it in an attractive way.
Right.
I think the problem with bringing a new manager in is they haven't got a great deal of cash. And so any rebuilding will be limited.
How exactly can you establish a premiership pedigree if you're fired once you get get your team promoted.
Well, chairman these days, all they seem interested in is success, ditto for fans. So I'm not saying it's an ethically right thing to do not to give a manager a chance, but if his only previous Premier League experience is failure, then perhaps he should be replaced.
Mm. Anyway, now, in the playoffs, Sheffield United, despite that 0-0 draw, Reading, Burnley and Preston North End, who go in thanks to the fact that Cardiff, who at one point looked a good shot for the playoffs, imploded spectacularly. It was the 6-0 defeat at Preston. If they'd only lost 5-0, they would have gone in. But
I think so. It might have been something along those lines. They only missed out on...
By one goal scored.
Yeah.
So it was the 6-0 defeat at Preston that really did for them.
Well, you could say that it was probably the 1-0 defeat at Sheffield Wednesday
yesterday
probably did for them. If they hadn't lost that, they'd be in.
Right.
And they weren't just a good shout for the playoffs at one point. They were a good shout for automatic promotion. They had games in hand that would have seen them in the top two had they won them. But unfortunately, they lost three of the last four to miss out.
Crikey.
And then in the playoffs, obviously, you've got, as you say, Sheffield United, Reading, Burnley and Preston. You can make a case for all four, really. Sort of, they've all got hope going in there. Preston and Burnley are probably the form teams, despite finishing fifth and sixth.
And the games are when?
The games are Friday, over the Friday and Saturday, and I think Monday, Tuesday. They're pretty swiftly done.
Crikey, okay. Meanwhile, we've got Leeds and Millwall facing each other in the League One playoffs. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, and a bit of a relief for the Football League. Yeah, well, the away fans are banned at both games, so I think the Football League are just relieved that they won't be facing themselves each other at Wembley.
Right.
Down at the bottom of the Championship, we want to mention that Norwich dropped at Charlton in horribly reminiscent fashion as the way they dropped out the Premier League when they lost 6-0 on the last day at Fulham, getting hammered 4-2 at the Valley.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for that, John. And we look forward to hearing more about the playoffs when they take place and that. Now, should we just do some posts at the end of part two? I think we've got room for that. Big shout out to you, Bongo24, who says, swine flu be damned. He's in San Luis Potosi, Mexico, which is the second most infected city on the planet. But keeping his chipper up, which is great news. Cable 1973, big riff this week was all about people's teams. Cable 1973 says, Barry, I'm convinced you're a cheese lover. Which is it to be? And he then lists various cheese, feta, dolce latte, gamberzola, etc. Barry's looking mystified because you're not a big cheese lover.
I like cheese, but I try not to eat it very often anymore because I'm trying to lose weight.
All right, interesting.
Yeah, I do like cheese, but I'm not sure what that list
of cheeses had to do. Hey Habib responded to the list of cheeses by saying, playing feta in goal is a mistake, he crumbles too easily, and then riffs on that. All very nice, your bench mostly stinks. Etc. Then we had a whole series where Keener came in with a kind of biblical. What's that?
There was too much punctuation in that post. It was very Stilton delivery.
Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, etc. Ooh, Roger Palmer responds to that and says, that's ridiculous. Matthew in gold. Everyone knows that Jesus saves. Cable 1973 wants to play Judas at left back. I think he's possibly. An Arsenal fan, I'm not sure about that. Not singing anymore says Jesus in goal. No, he's terrible with crosses. Berger one says au contraire, when he comes out for a cross, he nails it. It just went on and on, this one, spiralling out of control. Hey Habib then came up with a list of philosophers and comedians who he thinks could give the biblical team a game, featuring forwards Russell Brown and Pete Doherty on the basis that they can't fail to score, ignoring the fact, of course, that they both get caught in possession. A fair amount. Anyway, but the main thing on the post this week was deeper in the doo-doo. I rudely interrupted Sean mid-ant analogy last week when he was comparing something. Well, he said something was deeper in the doo-doo then, and we never found out what.
I don't think he knew himself. I think he was very pleased, secretly pleased that you interrupted him at that pivotal moment in his analogy.
Well, we invited listeners to complete his sentence, deeper in the doo-doo than, and the answers range from the... Bizarre, Ged Honey, I think, leading that category with deeper in the doo-doo than Scooby's Barber. Can anyone explain that to me?
Scooby-Doo.
Oh, I see. Scooby-Doo's Doo. That would be right. And Super Russ, deeper in the doo-doo than Kopi Luwak berries, which I imagine must be some kind of fruit that grows within dung or something. I'm not sure. I mean, there are a lot of scatological ones. My favourite from that category was Harry Kidnaps deeper in the doo-doo than Barry's dad with his hand up a cow's arse. Although we had James Harriet variations. Or even Zombie Loves Brains with deeper in the doo-doo than Rocco Siffredi on a weekday, which none of us here get. no knowledge of that oeuvre at all. Music, though, I think this is probably where the winner lies. Simpliticon says, deeper in the doo-doo than a doo-wop band. Ratso Albion, I suspect, maybe beats that with deeper in doo-doo than Lou Reed in the end of Walk on the Wild Side. That's very clever. Belmondo's Beard with a similar effort, deeper in doo-doo than The Police in 1980.
Yes.
I don't know how you feel, guys. Who would be the winner?
I was reading them earlier, and the only one that made me laugh out loud was Michael Barrymore related.
I quite like the one about The Police when I read it.
Really? Yeah. More than Walk on the Wild Side.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Well, Ratso Albion, you're my winner, but Belmondo's Beard, apparently. Sean Rashley promised some form of prize, I think, didn't he? Yeah. Anyway, that's.
Well, now he's got to have two. If you've got a winner and we've got a winner.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not democratic about the Belmondo's Beard. But anyway, kudos to all. That's it for part deux. And part three, very shortly, will feature a quick mention of Greece, Italy, and, the Bundesliga. Part three. Oh, Barry, this just in. Hold the ending Sean's sentence award, because
we were waiting for someone to join us in Eurosurf, we were having a discussion.
Hmm.
And we arrived at the conclusion that the Lou Reed, deeper in the doo-doo.
Well, then you said, aren't there lots of football players called doo-doo?
And if somebody scored a goal
and they all
piled on top of him to celebrate, then he would be deeper. So, but I can't win, obviously, because I'm a Guardian Media Group employee.
Thank God you arrived at that point, Paolo Bentini.
Paolo didn't technically arrive, because then we started discussing The Police and their song Walking on the Moon.
Right, yeah.
And
I know it's bank holiday, but let's press on, eh?
Right.
Now, a European roundup time. Thank you, Paolo, for joining us. In France, Marseille and Bordeaux are tied on 68 points. Lyon are now whopping 7 points behind, so it's game over for the Lyonnais as regards winning an 8th straight title. They are still just 1 point ahead of Paris Saint-Germain as regards maintaining their Champions League status. Bundesliga, what's going on over there, Raphael Honigstein?
What isn't going on?
What isn't going on, then?
Everything's going on, because you've got a team who's leading, Wolfsburg, but the manager wants to go to Schalke. You've got a team who were leading, Hoffenheim, whose manager wants to go because he doesn't get enough support from the owner, stroke wealthy billionaire in the background. You've got Bayern without a manager for next season, trying to sign Louis van Gaal.
Huh?
You've got Dortmund winning every single game in the last, I don't know how many months, and it's still only 5 points between the top five teams.
So right, okay, Wolfsburg on 60,
very close.
Bayern on 57 after winning their first game under Jupp Heynckes. Berlin,
Jupp Heynckes.
Okay, Bayern are on 57, 1 point behind them are Berlin, and 1 point behind them are Stuttgart and Hamburg. This with four games to go.
Yeah, and Stuttgart are playing Wolfsburg next.
Ooh.
So it's first against fourth next week. And Wolfsburg also have to play Dortmund the week after. Dortmund, as I said, have won six in a row now under Jurgen Klopp, the new manager. And the joke in Munich now is that Bayern got the wrong Jurgen in because...
Germans have no sense of
humor. Wrong. I don't find that funny. The wrong Jurgen K... because he came, of course, with a similar reputation for being a visionary and a sort of a new young Turk of German football, and he delivered, whereas our friend Klinsmann didn't.
Oh, okay. Any word on where Diego's going yet?
Well, Diego, I think, might be going to Bayern.
Right, okay, if Ribéry goes to Barcelona.
Ribéry, I think, might well go to a club that plays in red and the north-west of England.
Ooh, interesting, interesting.
Watch this space.
Middlesbrough.
Chester City.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
There is, with Louis van Gaal all but confirmed as the new Bayern manager, there is already the post-Ribéry era has almost started, and all sorts of plans, contingency plans being drawn up, how to spend all this money that's coming in.
Oh, nice. That's good then. Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Raphael.
Pleasure.
We mentioned back at the start that Greek game, Olympiakos beating AEK Athens in the Greek Cup final. It's going to go down apparently as the greatest Greek Cup final in history, although, as we all know, there's been some pretty special ones, haven't there, over the years.
1976 one was something else.
Was it? Yeah. And perhaps the greatest ever match in the Greek domestic scene, because they won 15-14 on penalties after a 4-4 draw in extra time with two red cards. There was also Matt Derbyshire scoring the goal that sent it into extra time. Apparently he was the player of the game after he came on. Good for you, Matt Derbyshire.
Stunning. I don't know if the penalty shootout is around on YouTube, and it's worth watching. Do you want to know the world record of worst penalty? If we're going, it feels like we're going to have another stat off.
Producer Ben doesn't want it, but I've got stat me till I.
Well, you know, we think the world record for number of penalties taken in a single shootout, because obviously I think there was 30,
right?
Assuming there was 30 in the Greek game, was 66 between.
Well, there must have been at least.
It must have been 30. Yeah. Must have been 30 at least.
They include the 4-4 draw in that, no?
Oh, yeah, fair point. Go on, then,
okay, well, anyway, the record is 66, we think, well, the most recorded that we can find, in January 1998, between two under-10 sides, Mikulova Lightning Blue Sox and Chelleston Boys, the game finished 1-1, and they took 66 penalties between them, and the penalty shootout finished 2-1.
This is just made up.
The child who missed the decisive penalty deserves to be named and shamed.
I haven't got it, although I do. I am Facebook friends with somebody who knows one of the goalkeepers in that game, bizarrely.
Wow. Talking about high-scoring football, Paolo Bandini, very, very interesting. We're kind of at the end of the pod, but there's so much to talk about. Let's roll on the Serie A coverage. What are you going to start with?
Can I just ask quickly before I start, why is it so cold in this pod?
Well, it's cold, isn't it?
You know. It's extremely cold, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It sharpens the mind, Paolo.
Sharpens the mind, right. Okay. We'll see. Yeah.
What have you got on your piece of paper?
What have I got on my piece of paper? My piece of paper has actually just got the run-ins for the two sides battling out for fourth place, which is Fiorentina and Genoa now.
Right.
Roma drew again at the weekend.
Can we just preface that with... Because last time you were here, we were talking about the fact that Roma had been thrown into a punitive training camp after their disastrous 4-1 defeat by Fiorentina. But they quickly got out of it.
Yeah, it was a very strange midweek. I mean, basically what happened is Francesco Totti and Daniele De Rossi just went to the prison, to Rosella Sensi, and said, you know, we don't need to do this. This isn't such a good idea. You should probably, you know, trust us to get things back on track and let us, you know, go back home and we'll get it done for you this weekend. And then they emphatically didn't. They drew 0-0 with Chievo. And you know, the interesting thing about this conversation with the president was that they never actually even mentioned that they were going to go and do this to the manager, Luciano Spalletti. So they've just gone, you know, straight above his head to get themselves out of this. You know, Sensi, who's clearly quite an emotional character, you know, she's really sort of doing whatever she can. She wants to do what she thinks is right for the club, and she's listened to them. And Spalletti sort of said, oh, well, actually, it's okay. You know, I didn't really agree with the punishment anyway, and, you know, I think they're just doing the right thing. But really, it looks more and more like he's, you know, on his way at the end of the season.
Now, of course, after that fantastic 0-0 draw, they're very likely to miss out on the Champions League.
Yeah.
And what sort of permutations does that throw up?
I think it's almost certain that they won't make the Champions League. Financially, it looks very, very difficult for them. One of the interesting things that came out at the end of this game was Spalletti, you know, not only talking about whether or not he's going to be there next season, but, you know, he pretty much came out and said, if the club, you know, are that worried about money, then we can talk about maybe I'll just not take a payoff when I go. So, you know, he's looking, as I say, very much in his way. But what that means in terms of selling players, I don't know, because you look at De Rossi and Totti, and they're these sort of, you know, local heroes who you almost can't imagine playing somewhere else, but they're also going to be the players that are making the big money. And if the club needs to cut somewhere, then that looks like where it could be. But then the other question is, you know, is there finally going to be someone come in and make a serious offer for this team? Because at the moment, Sensi is saying is, oh, they never came, you know, this German-Swiss group never came in with a serious offer. And, you know, the fans are saying, you're lying, you turned it down. But I suspect really that the truth is what she's saying. Because I think that at the moment she is, I mean, there was reports of her, you know, seen crying several times during this game. I think she's really struggling with it and would like to offload it if she could.
No, my word. Other splits currently going on around Serie A. Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Inter, after making all sorts of comments about how he fancies something new, and rumours in Spain about a massive contract on offer from Real Madrid. He put his fingers to his lips and said shh to the San Siro faithful, who had been booing and jeering Inter during their match with Lazio on Saturday night. Zlatan Ibrahimovic then inspired a 2-0 win and basically seems to have sent another message that he doesn't consider himself long for the Italian championship.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, yes, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, this ridiculous sense of entitlement also that's developed in Inter these days. You've got a lot of fans sort of you know, are basically still a bit bitter that they didn't get further in the Champions League, because, you know, the league has been so routine for them that now they're just sitting there going, well, why aren't you trying harder? Why didn't you try harder earlier? And Ibrahimovic basically hadn't done anything in the first few minutes of this game, but actually the team were dreadful again this weekend, and he was the only reason they won. So, you know, if he does go, I think they're gonna miss him.
It did end a run of, I think, four games without victory, which had seen Milan move a bit closer, but that victory effectively, I think, consigns the title to them. Milan did win at Catania to move 5 points clear of Juventus, where it looks like the end is nigh for Claudio Ranieri.
Yeah, and another team like Roma seemingly sort of coming apart at the seams at the moment. I mean, Ranieri is beginning to behave more and more like a desperate man. I mean, he tried a 4-3-3 this weekend that he hadn't really tried before. It was horrible in the first half. They were losing 1-0 to Lecce. And so at halftime he goes, right, Camoranesi, you're coming off. And Camoranesi just blew up in his face, basically, and started screaming at him, at which point Gigi Buffon just decides he's had enough and walks out the changing room. And basically Ranieri's lost all his authority there. And, you know, there was talk this morning that he might go even today and be replaced by youth team director Ciro Ferrara. But I'd be surprised if he doesn't end up hanging around until the end of the season, because I don't think there's any real point in Juventus letting him go at this stage. But
it was interesting, though, wasn't it? When you lose Buffon, who's usually one of the calmest and most dependable figures, and even after the first goal, he turned round to the crowd and mouthed to them, "I can't take this anymore." And all these photographs of him with his head in his hands after Juve had gone a goal down to one of the bottom three. Lecce, the second straight poor result against the bottom.
There's always this talk, even now, even though Given's gone there, that City are going to offer some huge amount of money for Buffon. I think if they did, then Juventus would be foolish to turn it down, because I don't think that he's necessarily playing at the level he was a few years ago. But yeah, I mean, in terms of what he represents to that team, he's sort of the, you know, one of that group of sort of core players who Juventus believe are dependable, like Del Piero. I mean, Camoranesi's always been a hothead. He's always been a bit of a difficult character. But, you know, the word coming out of the Juventus training room for a long time has been that not all the players have been signed up to Ranieri's systems, and it looks more and more like, you know, the proof of that is beginning to bear itself out.
Well, they haven't fired anyone mid-season for 40 years or something, yeah. Juventus, but as you say, the rumours are that might well happen in the next day or two. The other big bit of news, of course, is the fact that the much-heralded Italian version of the Premier League is now set to start in a year's time, although we've been close to this happening before and it never quite happened. This time, though, it's actually on the way.
I think I'd be surprised if it doesn't happen this time, because I think that there are too many of the big clubs that are beginning to not just, you know, think, oh, we could make more money, but actually becoming to get a little bit anxious about where the money's going to keep coming from. Like, you know, as we've said, Roma are in a bad financial way. Juventus are acting like they've got a lot of money, but I don't know that they're actually, you know, the new stadium hopefully will help. You know, they have built up some debt there, and you know, even Moratti is sort of making sounds like he's got to tighten some belts at the moment. Whether or not he will, we'll see. So I think that there's enough desire there now to start making more money that I think it'll go ahead.
Right, okay, well, they voted 19-1 to break away and form their own new competition. Basically, the split is over how much money they give the second division, which has always been a bugbear. John?
Well, so will they divide it up on the same lines as the Premier League, and that all the big teams will keep all the money and everybody else can go hang?
I think it won't be a million miles from that. You know, obviously there will be much more hand-wringing and wrangling and negotiating between now and it happening, but I would imagine that the whole point of this is to tie all that money up in the hands of the big teams.
They don't pay that much. I mean, in English terms, they don't pay, I think it's about 80 million euros to the second division at the moment. They want to reduce that. But the thing, I think, the worrying thing for other Italian clubs is that whilst you can get a lot of money from the TV rights in this country, I believe, and I think the Championship commands a certain amount of money, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In Italy, Serie B, they'd really be pressed to get.
Well, it's slightly different, isn't it? There's fewer teams, and then is it part time in Serie C and that sort of stuff. And it's,
when you get down to the fourth division, I think C1 is, but Serie B is you know, right, proper teams and proper players.
Okay.
But they're going to be squeezed hard. Very good. Today, the anniversary of Il Grande Torino.
That was the other thing I was going to mention. Mm. Yeah, today the anniversary of the 60th anniversary of the plane crash, which wiped out the great Torino team of the 1940s. Interestingly, actually, you know, not that much in the Italian press about it, but certainly for Torino, it's a really significant day. And, you know, for a long time, it was a really significant, important day for Italian football. I mean, this team was blisteringly successful. I mean, they'd won five titles in a row. They hadn't lost at home for something like 90 games when the accident happened. And, you know, at a time when European club football didn't really exist in the way that it did now, this team was, you know, travelling around Europe playing high-profile friendlies. They'd been the first Italian team to tour South America. And the whole team, you know, unlike with Manchester United's crash in Munich, where some people survived, this was the whole team got wiped out in one crash, effectively.
Apart from
one guy, Sauro Toma, who had stayed behind because he had a knee injury. Actually, he'd wanted to go on the trip anyway, but his wife was pregnant and persuaded him not to go.
Yeah.
And I believe the reserve goalkeeper as well. But basically, it wiped out what some people still herald, considered to be the best team ever in Italy, and certainly was a team that you would have imagined would have gone on to some pretty incredible things, given the precedent they'd set and how young most of the players were.
Yep, Valentino Mazzola and all that. All right, well, Paolo, thank you very much for that, and thank you to John Barry and Raphael for joining us today. We'll be back on Thursday with Football Equal Extra, Football Weekly Extra. Many, many thanks to producer Ben for doing this one on Bank Holiday Monday in Great Britain, and indeed in Nisbet orbit as well. And we'll be speaking to you Thursday. Bye-bye.